I'm Frank Vaughn. It is June 7th, 2026. Happy 100th day anniversary to the 24-48 hour war. And I suppose I could give you a highly technical update, but quite honestly, if you haven't figured out that what I was saying back in March has come to pass, there's no amount of evidence that's going to sway you otherwise at this point. There are some dangerous developments, though. And I'll admit, one of the things that I've been wrong about is I've been weekend after weekend thinking this is the weekend they get it started, because escalations on the weekend are planned escalations. Escalations on a Monday are the ones you really got to worry about. And I think we're actually heading towards a bad Monday. One of the insights that we can gain from the fact that full-scale war has not resumed is that all sides, except for the Israelis, all sides, and some, except for some politicians that are behind the president, don't want this thing to go back to full-scale war. They all know the levels of destruction that will be reaped if they go back to war on oil infrastructure in the Middle East, the damage on the global economy, which is already enormous. We're running out of runway. We'll start there. We got 4 or 5 weeks left before an oil price shock hits. There's two arguments. One is that oil will race to $200 to $300 a barrel, and that's possible. There's another argument that I find compelling, which is that over the course of the summer, as oil increasingly becomes more and more expensive, you'll have demand destruction, and oil will never reach those prices because people will stop buying it and economic activity will die. Both scenarios, of course, are absolutely terrible. And I think there's merit. I think there's a price ceiling where business activity just stops. The president has repeatedly said it's a small price to pay, that he's not concerned about it, that it's peanuts. His words, not mine. I'm not attacking the guy. I'm just calling it how I see it. Now, I want to go over a couple things at the very least. The last few days worth of tweets, anyway. After a furious campaign in Poland, World War II went quiet. The Sitzkrieg, the phony war, the drôle de guerre, lasted about 8 months. The opening phase of World War II was effectively over by October 1939, and all went quiet for 3/4. 8 months. Nothing happened. No one got shot. No bombs fell down. The border between France and Germany was quiet as everybody was trying to figure out what the next step was. And the next step, of course, was the Germans raffle stomping Holland and the Benelux countries and France. And then there was another brief pause. There was bombing campaigns, but there was the only thing I want to highlight, and maybe I should just finish reading the tweet. No one was getting shot. Time passed by as it does right now on a day-to-day basis. How it felt. Like when you pick up a book and you read a history book about the Second World War, you have to realize that you're capturing a good history book. We'll go through the 1930s and the 1920s as well. But if you're just focused and fixated on the war itself, it spans a number of years. But if you were living it on a day-to-day basis, it didn't come off as one cohesive whole. There were disparate crises. We only see it as a whole when we look back on it. World War II was contained for most of its early life. Is the current war still contained? This conflict is actually more violent than World War II in Europe for most of 1940. Think about it. Feel it. Read William Shire's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and just try to imagine the pace of each day. When I read, part of what I do is I meditate on what I'm reading. And I really try to get in the shoes of the people who live that. I try to feel it. I try to picture what it would feel like. And it's an active conscious exercise that I do. It gives me some insight into how things feel in modern times. And it's given me a lot of peace in the past. It's not giving me peace now. I'm not deriving peace from that process anymore. I'm deriving concern, and I'm seeing complacency bias in people sleepwalking all over the place who don't understand how grave this situation is, how historic this situation is. It would have felt very familiar to today, or very similar to today, though there was far less threat to the world than as now. Because even in 1940, the threat to the entire world from the European conflict was minimal. They didn't have nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles. And it was terrible. I'm not trying to diminish what World War II was, but I am trying to provide some insight into where we are today comparatively to then. And if you actually look at the theater of operation, you have to go outside of Iran. You have to see the world as a whole. Like historical perspective gives us the ability to look back on the Second World War and see it as a whole conflict from Asia to Europe. At the time, it was fragmented. And so today, the conflict in Ukraine is separate from the conflict in Israel and Lebanon, is separate from the conflict between Israel, the United States, and Iran, is separate from the issue around Taiwan. But it's actually one big whole. And that's how we're going to see it when we look back on it, if we have the benefit of perspective and we're able to do this kind of analysis. We're not just beating each other to death with sticks to steal each other's seeds. I genuinely hope our leaders walk this the fuck back. Europe and America need to cede some realism to this new multipolar world before Iran pops a nuke. I believe there's a very real threat in the near future that they will do a demonstration nuclear test. Now, it's not a guaranteed thing. I think they have every incentive to develop the capacity. But Iran has made strategic errors in the past. And I'm not sure test detonating a nuke will automatically equal North Korean-style insurance. Which is why I think they got to be very careful how they think about this and how they prosecute it and how they roll it out, if they're going to roll it out. Trump's tone has changed. I think he understands this as well, that Iran's at that point. One last point, quoting myself, World War II in Europe. When we look back at World War II, we see it as one massive connected conflict from the Pacific to the Atlantic, but back then, different conflicts were seen as separate, disparate. Asia was not Europe. Africa was not Asia. America was isolationist. Only in retrospect do we see it as completely intertwined. Franklin Delano Roosevelt won the election on an isolationist message. Very similar to Donald Trump now, who won the last election as the peace president and guaranteeing no new foreign wars, and is now delivering the potential for a global nuclear conflict. I mean, I'm not even kidding about that. That's the times we live in. Very volatile, very dangerous. Trump dismisses the idea that Iran betrays the Iran war. That's what it should be called. Even Canada. It's so weird how media is treating this conflict, because nobody wants to say anything good about Iran. And even though they hate Trump, they have the kid gloves on for criticizing this war effort because it's Iran and because Iran is outside of the globalist system. There's a lot of intel operations out there that will tell you that they are part of the globalist system. They're not. They don't have a central bank controlled by a particular network of families. They stand independent. And so even the Toronto Star treats this as kid gloves and removes war from their headline. But he's saying it doesn't betray his no new wars message. It's 100 days, okay? It was supposed to be over in 24 to 48 hours, and then it was 2 to 4 days. We're 100 days in. They're still firing missiles at each other. They're still hitting tankers. They're still bombing sites. U.S. bases in the Middle East are still being turned to Swiss cheese by Iranian missiles. And we've had some serious developments today, which is one of the reasons I'm filming this on a Sunday. Another thing I said is, if you make a habit of invoking the boogeyman to justify your political machinations, you just might find you summon him. And what I'm talking about there is Netanyahu in the United States for the last 40 years talking about Iranian nukes when they never had any. Talking about the threat to the Strait of Hormuz, even though Iran had never closed it before. You say it often enough, you invoke the boogeyman, and you just might summon him. And by that, I mean Iranian nuclear weapons, and now they have control of the Strait of Hormuz. Anything CENTCOM says or anything Donald Trump says about the Strait of Hormuz is automatically disproven just by looking at tanker traffic that is successfully navigating the strait, still at 1/10 the level that it should be, and most of it is going to Iranian allies. We're being gaslit by the president. We're being gaslit by CENTCOM. That's not me being having Trump derangement syndrome. That's just a dry analysis of the facts. And I think it paints a bad picture for what I would like for the future. The biggest takeaway everyone should get from the last 2 weeks or so is that Trump is not in charge. I'm gonna put meat on those bones. Stick with me. I warned last June that if he went to war in Iran, this would be the outcome. His influence outside the party would fail. resisting this war was his best leverage. The other thing that's happening is, this is the headline, vulnerable Republicans increasingly willing to defy Trump's agenda as midterms approaches. He has an ironclad grip on the Republican Party, but they can smell the blood in the water. They can see the future. They know from their internal polling that even though the polling houses might exaggerate the numbers, at the end of the day, Trump is deeply unpopular, and so is the Republican Party. And these are midterm elections. This isn't picking a president. This isn't picking a direction. It's not how Americans treat the midterms. This is a vote on whether or not to enable the presidency to do more of what it's doing, waging war in Iran, or to check those powers because they're raging out of control. And I think that's what the American public is preparing to do. All of the reliable polls show the exact same thing. It's not that the Democrats are any more sane. It's not that the left is any more attractive in messaging. This morning I was watching Midas Touch, as I sometimes do, because you have to know what they're saying. And they are the most nitpicky. You know, it's vain. It's every single video that they release starts with the words Donald Trump. So it's propaganda too, but they don't have to have a cohesive vision and message at this point. That's not what midterms are about. It's just it's bad news for the Trump administration. Now, I believe it was Thursday, going from memory. I think it was Thursday. It was Wednesday or Thursday. Trump comes out. They leak a phone call to Axios, or information on a phone call that Trump had with Bibi, where he's cussing him out and saying, "You'd be nothing without me." And he's cursing and swearing and carrying on. And the White House never denied it. When they, I can't remember the name of the individual. I want to say it's Hassan, but I think I'm wrong. There's a reporter over at Axios. And whatever he says, you know, came from the White House. It's their preferred way to leak information to the public. And they never denied it anyway. So Trump's on the phone with Netanyahu. He says he got Netanyahu to agree to a full-scale ceasefire. He says he made contacts through to Hezbollah through very well-connected people, and they agreed to a ceasefire. None of that is real. None of it is real. There is no ceasefire. And Iran has set a red line that if Israel bombed southern Beirut, they would fire on northern Israel. Today, this Sunday, we are testing that red line. And the Iranians have come out and said, where's the statement? I mean, no, like the headlines like this, U.S. and Iran remain far apart over sanctions relief and frozen assets. They remain far apart on everything. The only thing holding this whole thing together, it's not a ceasefire. I don't know what this is. This low boil of hostilities where everybody's getting shot every day. The only thing that's holding this together is the fact that the next step to go back to war this time will be total destruction in an irreversible way. You know, you bomb that oil infrastructure, you can't just snap your fingers and rebuild it. It's a lot of specialized technology. It's a lot of tradespeople. There's a lot that's already been invested in oil infrastructure over the last several decades. You can't replace that inertia, that momentum in terms of work. Some of that infrastructure is aging anyway. I don't believe the Trump administration wants to take that step, but their hand will be forced. Because Trump can call up Bibi Netanyahu and he can swear at him all he wants, or it could just totally be a concoction. It could have been a story they leaked to the press for domestic political reasons. Because that would be, if Trump is aware that he's losing his base because Israel is running his presidency, it would be very useful to leak a story that he is actually in conflict with Israel. Quite possible, it's just narrative making. There's a lot we don't know. But what we do know is one of Iran's red lines has been crossed today by these strikes on southern Beirut. And somewhere, here it is, Iran warns of direct confrontation amid Israeli attacks on Lebanon. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, says Iran will not only halt the path of negotiations, but we will also be in direct confrontation with the enemy following Israel's continued attacks on southern Lebanon and the capital of Beirut. He also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel, saying They are neither committed to a ceasefire nor believe in dialogue. And by demonstrating through the naval blockade and violation of agreements regarding Lebanon that they only understand the language of power. Naval blockade against the Iranian nation and America's green light today to the Zionist regime turn American and regime bases and assets in the region into legitimate targets. None of this is good news. And it also demonstrates very clearly that Trump is not in control. He's not in control of Netanyahu. He's not in control of the IDF. And as a bill advances through the U.S. political system to even further integrate the IDF into American war planning in a way that will be hard to reverse for future, that will put an Israeli, very likely, an Israeli citizen in the Pentagon to oversee what's happening in the Pentagon. It's like, man, you don't want to admit that. I certainly don't. I certainly didn't. You know AIPAC is powerful. You know the Israeli lobby is powerful. You know they fund and donate to just about every single American politician. But you really don't want to believe that a nation as powerful, an empire like the United States, of almost 400 million souls with bases all over the world, could be brought low by a tiny little nation of 9 million who is on an ethnic cleansing crusade in the Middle East. And that's what it is. I won't call it genocide because I don't think it's genocide. I don't think it's useful to call it genocide. I actually think it enables the ethnic cleansing by calling it genocide. It's the wrong word for what's happening. Ethnic cleansing is bad enough. Gaza is still being bombed. There's no ceasefire in Gaza. Remember all the positive copy and press Trump said about bringing peace to Gaza and the border peace and all this nonsense? They're getting bombed every single day. They're being starved out. They're being swept out. The Israelis are preparing to annex it. And they've also ordered out millions of people from southern Lebanon, and they're openly talking about in Parliament how they're not going to let them back. And the minister of, they actually have a minister of settlements, I think it's called, a minister of settlements in the Israeli Parliament. He was actively calling about the calling for the colonization of South Lebanon, along with Ben-Gvir and all of these other extremists that are in the Netanyahu government. If you think things are going to get better when they get to an election in October and Netanyahu goes to jail for corruption, once he can't escape that, the other party bloc is a Zionist political bloc. So you have a choice between two Zionist blocs. And a lot of the criticism of the prosecution of the war is that they're not going hard enough, they're not going fast enough. So what's the United States going to do when Iran strikes Israel? They've demonstrated in the past that they are willing to abandon their Gulf Cooperation Country partners and let missiles rain down on their assets and even missiles rain down on American bases in the Middle East before they will dedicate resources away from Israel. The vast majority of anti-ballistic missile and defense technologies that have been expended at this point in the Middle East by the American taxpayer with American lives has been the defense of Israel to the abandonment of everybody else. That's why the United States has lost Oman effectively, and they're going to lose other nations. You know, if you follow flight traffic, if you follow where the big planes, the big refueling tankers are flying, they're not going over Saudi airspace anymore. There's not a big press announcement. There's no big sign that tells you that things are changing. You have to look at actions. The Saudis have cold feet on the United States because of the damage the United States has allowed them to suffer while they unilaterally defend Israel and its aggressive foreign policy. Like the most absurd thing about this entire conversation is this notion that these are defensive operations. The United States goes and bombs Keshem Island, and they say it's a defensive operation to avoid legal problems back home because the president is not allowed to wage war in an unlimited way without the approval of Congress. But they're doing it anyway, just like every other American president has stretched the rules beyond the limit. Donald J. Bush. Sad to see. Doesn't make me happy. And meanwhile, I mean, this is what he's doing.
Trump, 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 Trump. Everywhere I go, they love Donald, Donald Trump. Down in Mexico, they love Donald, Donald Trump. Flew to Italy.
It's pretty wild, man. I mean, all the footage is fake. The song is fake. Everything is fake. It just kind of symbolizes where we are. And I mean, it's just his whole Truth Social is very disconcerting to me because it's all nonsense. And I can punch myself in the head all day. I can't make myself forget that this is the same man who not long ago was going to rallies around the United States bragging about cheap gas prices and how good he was doing on inflation and all this. It's all gone, man. Inflation is trending towards 6%, which I think is Nerf ball numbers because right now all the pricing structure in the commodities market is fake. The impact on oil is being mitigated by releases of strategic petroleum reserves around the world that are finite and will run out as this month ends and we move into July. I mean, look at the America 250 celebrations. It's the 250th anniversary of the Republic. What a beautiful day. What a beautiful day. And now it's becoming a MAGA rally. He desperately wanted to be president for America 250, and he is. And it's a disaster. And I don't know how people can't see it as a disaster now. As a Canadian, it's a disaster for me. But I don't know how much of a disaster because even in spite of... I was saying to somebody yesterday that we've... that America's been past the unipolar moment for almost 25 years. That... In 2016, one of my big, everybody was talking about how Trump, he's going to save America. He's going to make America great again. He's going to do all these things. And I said, you know, it's probably, that's a likely outcome. But we're talking about a reorganization period. It's going to take a decade. If it works perfectly, the American empire has to be scaled back. Things have to be reorganized and we have to adopt a more fortified economy and we have to adopt a more North American centric model. You're picking who's going to manage the decline. Do you want Hillary Clinton doing it? Do you want Kamala Harris doing it? Do you want Joe Biden managing the decline? Or do you want somebody who's had some experience, not only succeeding, but also managing decline, having failed enterprises? You know, you never hear me talk about Donald Trump's bankruptcies because that's life, man. For a lot of people, some of the most amazing mentors I have almost lost everything at some point in their life. They tried an idea. They raised funds. The idea didn't work. They went bankrupt. They lost almost everything. Barely hung on to the house. There's a dozen stories in my life like that. So I'll never talk about a man's bankruptcies and bad gambles. But this is America, man. The thing that remains to be done is the United States has to unilaterally exit and leave Israel on its own. That's what has to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. But that's the only outcome now. There's no negotiated settlement coming. The Israelis, as long as the Americans are dedicated to trying to create the image that Donald Trump has won this war, they're trapped. That's what they're trapped by. This idea that if they can somehow cut the Gordian knot and make a deal, Trump can spin this up and win, which he claims he doesn't care about the midterms. The first sign that he deeply cares about the midterms is the fact that he says he doesn't care about them. Oh, he cares. His legacy will be ripped asunder before he even leaves the White House if they lose the midterms. And they seem obsessed with this idea that they have to create the image of victory out of defeat, because that's what it is. It is a strategic defeat. Sure. The American military is largely intact. Sure, they've got aircraft carriers. I mean, have you seen the video coming out from the Ford, from the laundry fire? I mean, I'm no expert, but the damage doesn't look like it was done by a laundry fire. But all that said, the American military is still largely intact. but it's a strategic defeat all the same, because all the force in the world cannot beat Fortress Iran. I don't even know if nuclear weapons can do the job. You can kill a lot of people, but I don't know if you can defeat Iran in any kinetic way. And if you do that, if you go the nuclear route, which is really the only thing you can try to totally defeat Iran is nuclear weapons. And what happens to the world in the event that Israel or the United States decides to fire on Iran? And this brings us back to the whole Iranian nuke test thing, which I think might be coming. That might be just the excuse the Israelis need to use their nuclear weapons. And I think it'll be Israel. I don't think it'll be the United States that started down that road. I think it will be the Israelis. Think about your markets. Think about your price structures. Think about the global economy. What happens when there's a shock sufficient to wake the moneyed millionaires who are trading and speculating every day to finally make them wake up and realize that the bubble that we've all been living in, every single one of us living, except for, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they were talking about their neighbor who's 91 years old. And I got, after I got off the phone, I was thinking about that. 91. You do the math, and they were 10 years old, something like, when World War II ended. That's how old you have to have perspective to remember the last big global blow-up and conflagration. Most people alive, especially the ones that are playing games in the stock market and in the crypto market, which is also, I always found crypto to be a really good lead indicator. What it's doing, everything else tends to follow. Maybe not as harshly, but it's crypto is so responsive that it's the first sign of insecurity in the market. And if you look at it, it's looking insecure. People will say, it's just another bear market. Sure, there's a lot going on in the world. I think it's much more in a bear market. I think people are scared and nervous, and they're trying to find safe havens, but their safe havens of gold and silver have been in decline for months. And everybody's sitting in, I think a lot, Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars in cash. They're waiting for the crash. They're waiting to buy the blood. The big money has been dumping on retail for a long time now. You would think the repetition of patterns throughout the course of time and throughout history would alert the public, especially the public that has enough money to speculate in markets, that they're about to get wrecked again. But it just, information never seems to save the majority of people. The big money has been dumping on retail, and they're all sitting in cash because they intend to buy up everything once again when the whole thing falls apart. An event like a nuclear test in Iran or a response by the Israelis might just be the kind of event that wakes everybody up from their complacency. And then everybody's going to be reacting at the same time. And the best thing you can do, I was asked again yesterday by a friend, said, do you still see hope in Fortress North America? And I said, yeah, I do. But it's a matter of the pain to get there. This war and the geopolitical situation as it is right now is setting us up for max pain. Short of the worst outcome, which is global nuclear holocaust. It's setting us up for max pain instead of regulated pain, instead of mitigated pain. But I think the end point is the same. If there's national structures left, then the only game in town for anybody living in North America is to do business with each other. It's just a matter of how much pain and how many lives have to be lost between now and then. And the thing is, like, what can you do about this situation? Well, you can acknowledge what I'm saying. You can acknowledge that it's day 100 of the 24 to 48 hour war. You can acknowledge that Trump is not in control of the situation. You can acknowledge that the dreams that we shared a year and a half ago are on the ropes or gone, and you have to adjust your thinking And even if you're out of control, you are still in control of your own life. It's the same advice I gave in 2020. You need to be an island in the midst of the storm and let it pass by you. Whatever that means for you. It can apply to somebody living in an apartment in the middle of Toronto, and it can apply to somebody like me living deep in the bush. I still like my chances better than yours, but I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to gaslight you. I like my chances better than yours if you're living in that apartment in Toronto. But all the same, you can set that place up so that you're okay, so that you have what you need, so that the affairs of the world can pass you by. But the first step towards your success is to break out of the complacency bias before everyone else does. You know, the best opportunity in the market, whether it's crypto or stocks, is when no one else is buying. You buy when there's blood in the streets. You buy before the opportunity explodes. It's kind of like that. Once everybody figures out that the world is not going to move along tickety-boo the way that it did before, by July, August, we'll be really starting to get into the change, well, it'll be too late for you to get your advanced preparations done. The time to start was months ago when this stupid war started. When I tried to warn you in when I tried to warn in March, maybe February a little bit, I certainly talked about this in June of 25, that a war in Iran is the red flag. It is the major sign that if there is a really big conflict in Iran, the plan has gone off the rails. Now here we are. It's day 100. I'm still bringing that to you. Not for any selfish reasons. I'm not trying to sell you dried food. I'm not selling you iodine pills. Not that there's anything wrong with the people trying to sell you that. I'm just trying to give you that message for free and shake you up a little bit. Shake you up a little bit so that you can calmly go about preparing yourself for this future, which looks very different from the one I hoped we would be seeing in January of 2025 when Trump was coming in the second time. The peace message. Tulsi Gabbard, now gone. A lot of the good people in the administration are gone. They've been replaced by neocons. Ben frickin' Shapiro should be the press secretary. Pretty wild. Anyway, that's what I got for you on this Sunday. I have very little hope that the total repudiation of Trump's ceasefire that he claimed he had on Thursday by events gives me very little hope that anything that he's going to say today or tomorrow can actually prevent escalation if Israel is hell-bent on bombing South Beirut. Iran will strike. If they don't, I guess that means they blinked. And I suppose that's a good thing. But the issue with the good thing is that the slow grind of the blockade and the slow grind of the Strait of Hormuz doesn't end. And that slow grind, it's like putting the reverse of a deposit in a bank account. It's like it's taking withdrawals every day. It's taking loans every single day. Billions of barrels of oil in shortfall that is being plugged by the strategic reserves. The only way you can start to make up that shortfall is if you have to open everything back up. And when you open everything back up, because so much of the productive capacity of the Persian Gulf is now shuttered because they had to shut it down, turning it back on is going to cause its own damage. It's going to have its own consequences. So you're not plugging that deficit for months after it opens back up. So we're coming into an economic crisis. We're coming into a period of calamity. And the best thing you can do is just be as personally prepared for it as you can. You know, something I'll save because where are we at? 35 minutes. My Lord, can I go windy? I read an article this week, and it was the Globe and Mail. And the Globe and Mail is one of those mouthpieces that floats liberal ideas that are, they want to try, but they have to gauge the public first. And you know what I read? I read about how the only way to plug Canada's spiraling budget deficit is to cut entitlements to the elderly, to cut their pensions, cut their entitlements. They're actually writing it in the media. CBC didn't do splashy headlines. It was just in the Globe and Mail, quietly there. This is where they floated the idea of a tax on the principal value of your house. This is where they float some of their worst ideas. There's a lot of things that Canada can do before we cut entitlements to the elderly to plug our budget deficit. I mean, get rid of Global Affairs Canada. Just close it. Stop funding the CBC. There's $1 billion. We got a $100 billion deficit we need to plug. Oil revenues are up because the price is going up. I think the price is going to go higher, not lower, higher. But I think demand destruction is not going to set in until we get to much higher prices. But we'll see. But there's only so long that the strategic reserves and the paper market can hide over what is a serious supply shock, which is just over the horizon. Anyway, have a good Sunday. I'm Frank Vaughn. Talk to you in the next one.